Blog Talk Radio.
With a person because you regard him or her as a value and because they contribute to your personal happiness. Now, you couldn't fall in love with a person by saying, you mean nothing to me. I don't care whether you live or die, but you need me, and therefore I'm in love with you. If someone offered love of that kind, everyone would regard that as a deadly insult. That isn't love. Therefore, romantic love is a selfish emotion. It is the choice of a person as a great value. And what you fall in love with is the same values which you choose embodied in another person.
Altruism. Say it with me. Altruism. Altruism is defined as selflessness. Selflessness. Who doesn't aspire to selflessness? Anybody? We all want to be selfless, and we frown when someone says that we are selfish. It's almost a slur to say that Southern Sense, Tesla, you're a selfish bastards. You're selfish. Shame on you for being so selfish. So, because we're raised, a lot of us, from birth, to not be so selfish, we aspire to being selfless, meaning that our lot in life, our mission, our goal is to live for others, to live for our children, to live for our parents, to live for our loved ones, our husbands, our wives, our girlfriends, our boyfriends. How many times have you heard a mother say that she lives for her children? Or a father to say that he lives for his children. I live for my wife. I live and breathe for this person. Altruism is placing the interest of others above one's own interest in particular situations. What constitutes one's own interest and what others is a matter of definition and dispute. What many see as a sign of altruism may be interpreted as selfish behavior by others. It is a traditional virtue in many cultures and a core aspect of various religious traditions. Though the concept of others toward whom concern should be directed can vary among religions, altruism is the opposite of selfishness. Now, altruism can be distinguished from feelings of loyalty and duty. Altruism is a motivation to provide a value to a party who must be anyone but the self. And while duty focuses on a moral obligation toward a specific individual, for example, a god, a king, a politician, a president, or collective, for example, a government, some individuals may feel both altruism and duty, while others simply may not. Pure altruism is giving up a value, a reward, or benefit with no expectations of any compensation or benefits, either direct or indirect. For instance, from recognition of the giving. And the term altruism may also refer to an ethical doctrine that claims that individuals are morally obligated to benefit others. Used in this sense, it is the opposite of egoism. How many times have we been taught as children, New, Southern, GGT, Billy, and everyone else listening that it is right and it is good to look after the welfare and benefits of our fellow man, to take care of our fellow man, to put someone else above ourselves, to live for the good not just of oneself but for all mankind. Ayn Rand, the author of The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, did not believe this. She believed that one should live for oneself. one should live for the benefit of oneself, and thus, as fallout, enrich the lives of others. For example, does anyone within the sound of my voice believe that Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak built the first Apple computers in their garages for the benefit of all mankind? For the benefit of you, GGT, or you, Southern Sense, or you, Tesla, or you, Billy? Do you think he invented those for your benefit? Hardly. Those two men thought it was cool. They thought it was cool, then they realized they could make a shitload of money by selling what they think is cool to you and me. It wasn't for the benefit of all mankind. It wasn't to better and enrich the masses. It wasn't to bring enlightenment to anybody. It was to line their pockets. It was to get the girl. The inventor of Windows, Microsoft, Bill Gates. Do you think Bill Gates invented Microsoft and Windows? Rather, he stole Windows from Steve Jobs, but we can talk about that later. Do you think he did it so he could benefit anybody but himself? No, he did not. I have it on good authority from his own words, not spoken to me directly, but in a variety of media, that he invented or came up with the ideas for all that he's created because he thought it was cool. And if we, the masses, benefit from his creations, so be it. But that's not why he did it. Greed is good. Billy says it in the chat room. Greed, and to get the girl. This is the reason why men do what we do. It's no secret anymore. The reason why we aspire to greatness. The reason why we dress the way we do. The reason why we drive the cars we drive. Is because it's cool and to get the girl. And it has nothing to do with anything else. Everything else we do as a result of being cool and getting the girl, well, that's just fallout. Do you think I started my companies after leaving the Marine Corps to benefit anybody but me? The little bit of knowledge that I spread that may or may not benefit anybody, that's just icing on the cake. It's a beautiful thing. But I do it because on my military pension, I make slightly less than $6,000 a month. And folks, for 30 years service, that's just not paying all the bills because I buy a lot of stuff. So I need to make some more money. So I started a series of internet companies. And I make a pretty good chunk of change. And in the long, 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 long run, it benefits people. Altruism. Take a listen to this clip from My Girl and Yours, Ayn Rand, in an interview in 1965 with Mike Wallace.
Your sense of the word. I'm not putting emotional impression. Is that your impression?
Mike Wallace, Ayn Rand, 225-5.
practiced it all my life.
This is Mike Wallace with another television portrait from our gallery of colorful people. Throughout the United States, small pockets of intellectuals have become involved in a new and unusual philosophy which would seem to strike at the very roots of our society. The fountainhead of this philosophy is a novelist, Ayn Rand, whose two major works, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, have been bestsellers. We'll try to find out more about her revolutionary creed and about Miss Rand herself in just a moment. And now to our story. Down through history, various political and philosophical movements have sprung up, but most of them have died. Some, however, like democracy or communism, take hold and affect the entire world. Here in the United States, perhaps the most challenging and unusual new philosophy has been forged by a novelist, Ayn Rand. Miss Rand's point of view is still comparatively unknown in America, but if it ever did take hold, it would revolutionize our lives. And I am to begin with. I wonder if I can ask you to capsulize. I know this is difficult. Can I ask you to capsulize your philosophy? What is Randism?
First of all, I do not call it Randism, and I don't like that name. Call it objectivism.
All right.
Meaning a philosophy based on objective reality. Now, let me explain it as briefly as I can. First, my philosophy is based on the concept that reality exists as an objective absolute, that man's mind, reason, is his means of perceiving it, and that man needs a rational morality. I am primarily the creator of a new code of morality which has so far been believed impossible, namely a morality not based on faith. Not on faith, not on arbitrary whim, not on emotion, not on arbitrary edict, mystical or social, but on reason, a morality which can be proved by means of logic, which can be demonstrated to be true and necessary.
All right.
Now, may I define what my morality is?
All right.
Because this is merely an introduction. My morality is based on man's life as a standard of value. And since man's mind is his basic means of survival, I hold that if man wants to live on earth and to live as a human being, he has to hold reason as an absolute, by which I mean that he has to hold reason as his only guide to action, and that he must live by the independent judgment of his own mind, that his highest moral purpose is the achievement of his own happiness, and that he must not force other people nor accept their right to force him, that each man must live as an end in himself and follow his own rational self-interest.
May I interrupt now?
You may.
Because you put this philosophy to work in your novel Atlas Shrugged.
Right.
You demonstrate it in human terms in your novel Atlas Shrugged. And let me start by quoting from a review of this novel, Atlas Shrugged, that appeared in Newsweek. It said that you are out to destroy almost every edifice in the contemporary American way of life, our Judeo-Christian religion, our modified government-regulated capitalism, our rule by the majority will. Other reviews have said that you scorn churches and the concept of God. Are these accurate criticisms?
Yes, I agree with the facts, but not the estimate of this criticism. Namely, if I am challenging the base of all these institutions, I'm challenging the moral code of altruism, the precept that man's moral duty is to live for others, that man must sacrifice himself to others, which is the present-day morality.
What do you mean by sacrifice himself for others? Getting to the point.
One moment. Since I'm challenging the base, I necessarily would challenge the institutions you named, which are a result of that morality.
All right.
And now, what is self-sacrifice?
Yes, what is self-sacrifice? You say that you do not like the altruism by which we live. You like a certain kind of Ayn Randist selfishness.
I would say that I don't like is too weak a word. I consider it evil. And self-sacrifice is the precept that man needs to serve others in order to justify his existence, that his moral duty is to serve others. That is what most people believe today.
Well, yes, we're taught to feel concerned for our fellow man, to feel responsible for his welfare, to feel that we are, as religious people might put it, children under God and responsible one for the other. Now, why do you rebel? What's wrong with this philosophy?
But that is what, in fact, makes man a sacrificial animal, that man must work for others, concern himself with others, or be responsible for them. That is the role of a sacrificial object. I say that man is entitled to his own happiness and that he must achieve it himself, but that he cannot demand that others give up their lives to make him happy. Nor should he wish to sacrifice himself for the happiness of others. I hold that man should have self-esteem.
And cannot man have self-esteem if he loves his fellow man? What's wrong with loving your fellow man? Christ, every important moral leader in man's history, has taught us that we should love one another. Why, then, is this kind of love, in your mind, immoral?
It is immoral if it is a love placed above oneself. It is more than immoral. It's impossible. Because when you are asked to love everybody indiscriminately, that is, to love people without any standards, to love them regardless of the fact of whether they have any value or virtue, you are asked to love nobody.
But in a sense, in your book, you talk about love as if it were a business deal of some kind. Isn't the essence of love that it is above self-interest?
Let me make it concrete for you. What would it mean to have love above self-interest? It would mean, for instance, that a husband could tell his wife, if he were moral, according to the conventional morality, that I am marrying you just for your own sake. I have no personal interest in it, but I am so unselfish that I am marrying you only for your own good.
Well, should husbands and wives, Ayn, tally up at the end of the day and say, well, now, wait a minute, I love her if she's done enough for me today, or she loves me if I have properly performed my functions?
No, you misunderstood me. That is not how love should be treated. I agree with you that it should be treated like a business deal, but every business has to have its own terms and its own kind of currency. And in love, the currency is virtue. You love people not for what you do for them or what they do for you. You love them for the values, the virtues, which they have achieved in their own character. You don't love causelessly. You don't love everybody indiscriminately. You love only those who deserve it.
And then if a man is weak or a woman is weak, then he is beyond love?
He certainly does not deserve it. He certainly is beyond. He can always correct it. Man has free will. If a man wants love, he should correct his weaknesses or his flaws, and he may deserve it. But he cannot expect the unearned, neither in love nor in money,
but
neither in matter nor spirit.
You have lived in our world, and you recognize the fallibility of human beings. There are very few of us, then, in this world, by your standards, who are worthy of love.
Unfortunately, yes, very few. But it is open to everybody to make themselves worthy of it, and that is all that my morality offers them.
If they will
a way to make themselves worthy of love, although that's not the primary motive.
Let's move ahead.
Okay, now let me ask you this. You're on with the C. Robert Jones Conservative Report. Today's date, August 15th, 2011. Beautiful Washington, D.C., United States of America, planet Earth, third planet from the sun. The call-in number is 347-884-8500. How many of you, David, Antoinette, Southern, New, Billy, how many of you love everybody? How many of you love everybody the neighbor across the street, the guy at the grocery store, or maybe even that damn guy at the Walmart who doesn't say anymore, "Welcome to Walmart," because Sam is dead. And they don't feel like they have to say "Welcome to Walmart" anymore. They simply check your receipt if they think you might have stole something. And for those they think might be honest, they let you just go on by. They don't say, "Hey, welcome to Walmart anymore." Do you love everybody, including that lazy ass at the Walmart who doesn't say "Welcome to Walmart" because now Sam's dead and they don't have to? Do you love your fellow man? Everybody. Everything is beautiful in its own way. Do you love everybody? And Southern, Billy, David, Tesla, if you're married, do you love your wife just because she's there? Could you just love anybody, any woman, anybody's woman, equally? If so, what is love? Do you think Ayn Rand was right? Do you agree with Ayn Rand? I do. I believe that a man, and indeed a woman, must live for themselves first. I have children. I have 4 children. I do not live for my children. I never have. Maybe that's harsh to some people, because I know some people out there who will say that they live for their children. They live for their wives. I live for me. I live for me. Now, we have a current president who says that we need to take care of everybody. Everybody must chip in. Everybody must share in the sacrifice. We must have shared sacrifice, that we are one people, one nation, that we are a collective. That we are a collective, and that it's each man's responsibility to take care of the next man. Now, Antoinette writes in the chat room that she lives for her children. Then I would suggest that Antoinette's not living at all. Because if you live for your children, then what are they doing? Who are they living for? They don't have any children, maybe. Who are they living for? If Antoinette is living for her children, is Antoinette living? Who is living for Antoinette? Who is living for Tesla? Who is living for Billy? Is anyone living for Tesla? Is anyone living for Billy? I don't think so. As I stated, I have 4 children. All the very best America has to offer. Punched every ticket. Done everything exactly the right way. No earrings, no tats, no smoking, no drinking, no bad behavior. They are quite possibly perfect children. They all serve our nation's military as Marine and Naval officers. Do I live for them? Have I ever lived for my children? No, I live for me. And my children do not live for me. And I would hope that my children will not live for their children. I live for me. Now, anybody who says that they live for another person, I wonder, who lives for you? Who lives for you, Antoinette? Your mama? As much as I love my mama, and as close as we were, I hardly think that my mother ever lived for me. No, she gave birth to me. She took care of me. She loved me. She nurtured me. She taught me. She set me on the right path. Did she live for me? No, and I'm glad that she didn't. I'm glad that my mom lived her own life and was happy. How can you be happy living for someone else and not yourself? We have only one life. Unless one believes in reincarnation, why live your life living for someone else? Then what is your purpose? Tell me, what is the purpose of a person living a life that may last for, on average, 80 years, and live that one and only life for someone else? Barack Obama says that we need shared sacrifice. And there was a man, Huey Long, who said that we needed to spread the wealth, that we needed to, those who made money needed to, only needed so much of it, and the rest they should give away to their fellow man so that they're taken care of. So, in other words, according to Huey Long and Barack Obama, I should exist for everyone else. That if I go out and invent the next microchip, the next big thing, the next pet rock, the next Cabbage Patch doll, the next Beanie Baby, then I owe it to society to share in my riches. I owe it because I'm part of a collective, and everything that I own, every thing that I make or create, doesn't really belong to me. It belongs to someone else. It belongs to everybody. I would wonder if my good friend Antoinette, if she invented, let's say Antoinette invented the new Cabbage Patch doll, and she reaped millions from said Cabbage Patch dolls. She's got a lot of money. Her children are struggling. They're not doing so well. I'm not saying this. I'm just giving an example. Does Antoinette owe her children some of that bread from inventing the Cabbage Patch doll? The new Cabbage Patch doll? Does she owe it to them? Does Antoinette owe me some of that jack from the new Cabbage Patch doll? Does Antoinette owe Billy? Does Antoinette owe her cousins? Does she owe it to any of us to share her wealth? Now, according to Huey Long, the Kingfish, and now Barack Hussein Obama, the two cars that I have in my garage, the new Nissan Pathfinder and the Nissan Maxima. Well, I only need one car. I can only drive one car at a time. So why not take one of those cars, preferably the Pathfinder, according to Barack Obama and the Kingfish, and give it to a mother who made the sad mistake of laying down with the wrong man and making a bunch of babies that she didn't really have the wherewithal to take care of. She's struggling. So, according to the Kingfish, And according to Barack Obama, I should voluntarily give up my 8-seat capacity Nissan Pathfinder to this mother who made all the wrong choices, all the wrong judgments, so that she could ferry her little rugrats to the schoolhouse, or the outhouse, or the crack house. And if I don't see within my heart to give up my fine automobile that I worked hard for and earned and paid for with my own money, then the government has an obligation to take it from me and spread the wealth. Because it's not about shared prosperity. It's about sharing the wealth. That's what it's all about. Now, my good friend and I, Antoinette, we disagree. We disagree because I don't live for my children. And I've come close to dying dozens of times. Dozens of times. Dozens of times. In very gruesome and painful ways. I do not live for anybody but me. Did I say I've got to get up after being shot twice and get to safety or fire back because I have to have this life for my children? No. I said, I got to get up. I got to return fire. I got to get to cover so I can live to see another day. Didn't think of my children, my mama. Nothing like that. Maybe I'm selfish. Are you selfish? Billy, are you selfish? Antoinette, are you selfish? Tesla, are you selfish? Mays? Do you believe that you were put on this earth for a purpose other than popping out a few children and living for them and then dying? Or do you believe that God put you on this earth to live, to truly live for yourself? Be productive. Enjoy your God-given life. Make the most of that life and not live for anyone but yourself. The call-in number is 347-884-8500. We'll be right back because we've got some more of Ayn Rand. And I want to go ahead and play a clip from Ayn Rand and how she feels about love. And tell me if you believe what she's saying is true.
You fall in love with a person because you regard him or her as a value and because they contribute to your personal happiness. Now, you couldn't fall in love with a person by saying, you mean nothing to me. I don't care whether you live or die, but you need me, and therefore I'm in love with you. If someone offered love of that kind, everyone would regard that as a deadly insult. That isn't love. Therefore, romantic love is a selfish emotion. It is the choice of a person as a great value, and what you fall in love with is the same values which you choose embodied in another person.
Who agrees? Who among us agree that you don't love another person just because they exist? That you don't love your husband or your wife simply because they're breathing air. You love them for what they bring to the table in terms of their values, in terms of what they do for you and with you. Yes, in terms, not in tangible terms, not in terms of wealth or riches of any kind, but for the overwhelming sense of whatever it is that they bring to you that no one else can? Or do you, Maze, love your husband just because he exists and is breathing air and he just happened to be standing in front of you at the time? The person who spoke, Maze, was Ayn Rand, the author of The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. Do we love unconditionally? Who do we love unconditionally besides perhaps our children? I love my children unconditionally. But if any one of my children show up at my door, the first thing I do after greeting them with a hug and a kiss is I check for earrings and I check for tats. And if I see either one of them, they know they better not come to my house. If they've gotten an earring, unless you're a girl, the two boys, there'll be no earrings and there'll be no tats. And you will be dressed properly. Otherwise, don't bother showing up. Because we're going to lose a little bit of love if I see either of those things. So I even have conditions for my children. Do you have conditions for your husband, for your wife? Are you happy to lie and say to me that you love your husband unconditionally? We'll be right back.
He promised to change direction. 800 billion in stimulus. Trillions for government health care. 2 million jobs. Gone. Left turn after left turn. America's headed the wrong way fast. 6 million foreclosures. 14 trillion in debt. 500 billion in higher taxes. And the worst long-term unemployment in generations. Don't let Obama drive us to disaster. Change direction. Republican National Committee is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Long believed a speaker needed to entertain to be effective. All of his speeches are marked with humor, colorful language, and a forceful delivery. Long would occasionally hold press conferences in his pajamas. He never wrote speeches ahead of time, believing that notes made his delivery stale. He could tailor his speeches to any audience, having an almost intuitive understanding of appropriate language. In an instant, Long could switch from crude barnyard talk to religious homily. Journalists loved to quote him, and radio stations would compete to offer airtime. His message was simple. America must redistribute its wealth.
Every man a king, every girl a queen, or you can be a millionaire.
To promote this idea, Long started a grassroots campaign. This effort was not to be taken lightly. By 1935, over 7 million people had signed up, and nearly 20,000 new members were joining daily. Just before the end of the fall session of Congress, Long spoke to a group of staff members on Capitol Hill.
According to the tables which we have assembled, it is our estimate that 4% of the American people own 85% of the wealth of America, and that over 70% of the people of America don't own enough to pay the debts that they owe. How many men ever went to a barbecue and would let one man take off the table what's intended for 9/10 of the people to eat? The only way you'll ever be able to feed the balance of the people is to make that man come back and bring back some of that grub he ain't got no business with. How are you going to feed the balance of the people? What's Morgan and Baruch and Rockefeller and Mellon going to do with all that grub? They can't eat it. They can't wear the clothes. They can't live in the houses. Give them a yacht. Give them a palace. Send them to Reno and give them a new wife when they want it, if that's what they want. But when they've got everything on the God's living earth that they can eat and they can wear and they can live in, and all that their children can live in and wear and eat and all their children's children can use, then we got to call Mr. Morgan and Mr. Mellon and Mr. Rockefeller back and say, come back here. Put that stuff back on this table here that you took away from here that you don't need. Leave something else for the American people to consume. And that's the problem. We're not going to destroy the Gulf Refining Company. We're not going to destroy the Standard Oil Company. But we're going to say that the limit of any one man's stock ownership in the Standard Oil Company is from $3 to $5 million to that individual, and that the balance of the people of America own the balance of what the Standard Oil Company is worth. All right. Then, we start from the bottom, that the 25 or more million American families shall have a homestead, a home, and the comforts of a home, including an automobile and a radio, the things it takes in that house to live on. We say to America, 125 million, none shall be too big, none shall be too poor, none shall work too much, none shall be idle. No luxurious mansions empty, none walking the streets, none impoverished, none in pestilence, none in want. But in the land blessed by the smile of the Creator, with everything to be consumed, to be eaten, to be worn, that America will become a land sharing the fruits of the land, not for the favored few, not to satisfy greed, but that all may live in a land in which the Lord has provided an abundance sufficient for the luxury and convenience of the people in general. I think.
Long recognized that his plan had faults. When told that confiscating funds from American millionaires would provide less than $1.50 for each poor family, Long replied, "Well, when they figure that out, I'll have something new for them." Besides, he continued, "There are 20 million votes in that."
So really, we're back with the C. Robert Jones Conservative Report. So really, it was all a big scam. Huey Long talked about sharing the wealth. Altruism. Huey Long talked about others living for others. There are some folks in the chat room who say they live for their children. I can honestly say that I've never lived for my children. I can honestly say that my mother never lived for me. My mom lived for herself. She gave me life in order that I may live for myself. She did the things that a mother was expected to do. She went above and beyond the call of duty many times with me, her firstborn son. But I can tell you, my mother never lived for me. She lived for herself, and I really do appreciate that, because in my mother living for herself, I saw happiness, and I was happy. When my mom was happy, we were all happy. And my mom lived, and I didn't have to worry about anything. I didn't have to worry about my mom worrying about me. Because she did her job well. And there was no reason for my mom to live for me. Because she gave me all the tools necessary to negotiate this world, this life. And she need not live for me. There was no, back then, back when you and I were young, there was no going to high school, finishing high school, and coming back and living in mama's house and living off my mom and dad. There was no going off to college and then finishing college and then coming back and living in my mother's house. If we had done that, any of us, any of her five children, we would have been considered to be failures. Failures. My mom would have considered herself a failure. My dad would have considered himself a failure as a parent to adequately prepare her children for life's challenges and vicissitudes. So my mom and dad, they did their jobs and they lived for themselves. Once the last child was out of the house, and even before, they took lavish vacations. They did all really great things together. They lived for themselves. And they gave us the most precious gift, and that was the gift of life. So who do you live for? Who do you work for? When you go to work, Billy, Mays, Antoinette, David, when you go to work, do you work for yourself? Do you live for yourself? Or do you live for your children and your grandchildren and your neighbors and your cousins and your nieces and your nephews? When does it stop? When do you start living for you? Antoinette says, and May say that in the chat room, that men simply don't understand how a mother can live for her children. How is that possible? I would ask Mays and Antoinette, when do you start living for you? Mays, Antoinette, you've got about 80 years, according to statistics. When do you start living for you? Because chances are your children are going to outlive you. So if you're living for your children, when do you start living for you? Never. Never. Because here's the thing. When we have all this talk about shared sacrifice and being part of a collective where if I make a certain amount of money, I should be taxed a certain amount of money in order to pay for someone else to live. Thus, inadvertently, I am being forced to live for someone else. When I work and I make money off my intellect, my labor, whatever it is, any of you, Mays, Antoinette, the Southern Sense, New, David, when you go out and work and make money, and you're being taxed a certain amount for infrastructure, city, highways, roads, all of that that you use, that's fine. I can handle that. But when you're being taxed so that someone else can put their child through college, when you have two, three, four children of your own, but yet the government decides they're going to tax you so that they can have money to distribute to needy families so that they can send their kids to school, and they didn't work as hard as you did, or they didn't really put forth the effort, they didn't punch every single ticket They didn't think they had to, because there's always somebody else. There's always just another government handout just down the road. So why work? Why make an effort when all you have to do is sit back and listen to a president, a politician, say that those corporate jet owners, those fat cats, those rich folks should be paying more, because after all, it's only fair. It's only fair that we tax Mays more money. It's only fair that we tax Southern. It's only fair that we tax David Graham, who's probably sold a million copies of his latest book and is living quite large. Well, David, you know, so what if you worked really hard all hours of the night to produce a masterpiece called Stay Mad? We're going to go ahead and tax some of that, Jack, because little Miss Thing down the street opened her legs with some disgraceful scum, and 9 months later out popped another little rug rat, and oh, she didn't give a thought at the time that, well, I don't really have the wherewithal to take care of this little thing. So now I need to go to the government and get some money so that I can pay for this child that I've created with this lowlife who, oh, by the way, I really wasn't giving much thought to whether he was educated or whether he wanted to be a father or whether he had the means to support a child. I really wasn't thinking about that at the time, but now that I've got this little child, I need to go ahead and figure out a way to take care of it. I know what. I'll head on over to the welfare office and I'll get some money to take care of this kid. But where does that welfare money come from? It comes from Southern. It comes from David. It comes from Mays. It comes from New. It comes from Tesla. And Mama doesn't feel like she has to work, because now, inadvertently, we're all paying for this. Is that what it means by altruism? Sharing the wealth? Are we sharing the wealth? Should we share our prosperity? Should we be forced to share it? Should we? We're going to take another listen. Just one more listen against. We're going to listen to John Galt's speech. I'm probably not going to play the whole thing because it's almost 9 minutes long. But take a listen to John Galt's speech from the movie The Fountainhead.
The hand of the clock reached the dot of 8 o'clock. "Ladies and gentlemen," said a voice that came from the radio receiver, a man's clear, calm, implacable voice, the kind of voice that had not been heard on the airwaves for years. "Mr. Thompson will not speak to you tonight. His time is up. I have taken it over. You were to hear a report on the world crisis. That is what you are going to hear." Three gasps of recognition.
"This official sent the aircraft and plans to attack not just Bin Laden, but the Taliban rulers of Afghanistan, who allowed him to operate from their territory, killing Bin Laden and destroying his camps, or forcing the Taliban."
"Arrest me. I'll talk at the trial."
"We don't have to wait for the trial to convict him. Howard Roark is guilty by his very nature. Who is society? We are. Man can be permitted to exist only in order to serve others. He must be nothing but a tool for the satisfaction of their needs. Self-sacrifice is the law of our age. The man who refuses to submit and to serve, Howard Roark, the supreme egoist, is a man who must be destroyed."
"We have never learned to understand what is greatness in man. Self-sacrifice, we drool, is the ultimate virtue. Let's stop and think. Can a man sacrifice his integrity, his rights, his freedom, his convictions, the honesty of his feeling, the independence of his thought? These are a man's supreme possessions. To what must he sacrifice? To whom? Self-sacrifice? But it is precisely the self that cannot and must not be sacrificed. A man's self is his spirit. It is the unsacrificed self that we must respect in man above all. And where do we find it? In a man like Howard Roark. Have that run off and set up on tomorrow's front page.
Yes, Mr. Wynett.
Ellsworth, what are you after?
Power. What do you think is power? Whips, guns, money? You can't turn men into slaves unless you break their spirit, kill their capacity to think and act on their own. Tie them together, teach them to conform, to unite, to agree, to obey. That makes one neck ready for one leash.
Ellsworth.
You've heard me preaching it for years, but you didn't have the wits to know what you were hearing. Why do you suppose I denounce greatness and praise mediocrities like you? Great men can't be ruled. Why did I preach self-sacrifice? If you kill a man's sense of personal value, he'll submit. Can you do that to Howard Roark? No? Then don't ask me why I want to destroy him. That's what they mean, your noble ideals. You believed in me. Well, what's left of you now? Come on. Who designed Cortland?
Howard.
I solemnly ask of every man who hears this case to let his own mind pronounce a verdict upon it. You have heard the testimony of the state's witnesses. The confession of Peter Keating has made clear that Howard Roark is a ruthless egoist who has destroyed Cortland Holmes for his own selfish motive. The issue which you are to decide is the crucial issue of our age. Has man any right to exist if he refuses to serve society? Let your verdict give us the answer. The state rests.
The defense may proceed.
Your Honor, I shall call no witnesses. This will be my testimony and my summation.
Take the oath.
Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do. Thousands of years ago, the first man discovered how to make fire. He was probably burned at the stake he had taught his brothers to light, but he left them a gift they had not conceived, and he lifted darkness off the earth. Throughout the centuries, there were men who took first steps down new roads, armed with nothing but their own vision. The great creators, the thinkers, the artists, the scientists, the inventors, stood alone against the men of their time. Every new thought was opposed. Every new invention was denounced. But the men of unborrowed vision went ahead. They fought, they suffered, and they paid, but they won. No creator was prompted by a desire to please his brothers. His brothers hated the gift he offered. His truth was his only motive. His work was his only goal. His work, not those who used it. His creation, not the benefits others derived from it. The creation which gave form to his truth. He held his truth above all things and against all men. He went ahead, whether others agreed with him or not, with his integrity as his only banner. He served nothing and no one. He lived for himself. And only by living for himself was he able to achieve the things which are the glory of mankind. Such is the nature of achievement. Man cannot survive except through his mind. He comes on earth unarmed. His brain is his only weapon. But the mind is an attribute of the individual. There is no such thing as a collective brain. The man who thinks must think and act on his own. The reasoning mind cannot work under any form of compulsion. It cannot be subordinated to the needs, opinions, or wishes of others. It is not an object of sacrifice. The creator stands on his own judgment. The parasite follows the opinions of others. The creator thinks. The parasite copies. The creator produces. The parasite loots. The creator's concern is the conquest of nature. The parasite's concern is the conquest of man. The Creator requires independence. He neither serves nor rules. He deals with men by free exchange and voluntary choice. The parasite seeks power. He wants to bind all men together in common action and common slavery. He claims that man is only a tool for the use of others, that he must think as they think, act as they act, and live in selfless, joyless servitude to any need but his own. Look at history. Everything we have, every great achievement has come from the independent work of some independent mind. Every horror and destruction came from attempts to force men into a herd of brainless, soulless robots without personal rights, without personal ambition, without will, hope, or dignity. It is an ancient conflict. It has another name: the individual against the collective. Our country, the noblest country in the history of men, was based on the principle of individualism, the principle of man's inalienable rights. It was a country where a man was free to seek his own happiness, to gain and produce, not to give up and renounce, to prosper, not to starve, to achieve, not to plunder, to hold as his highest possession a sense of his personal value, and as his highest virtue his self-respect. Look at the results. That is what the collectivists are now asking you to destroy, as much of the earth has been destroyed. I am an architect. I know what is to come by the principle on which it is built. We are approaching a world in which I cannot permit myself to live. My ideas are my property. They were taken from me by force, by breach of contract. No appeal was left to me. It was believed that my work belonged to others to do with as they pleased. They had a claim upon me without my consent, that it was my duty to serve them without choice or reward. Now you know why I dynamited Cortland. I designed Cortland. I made it possible. I destroyed it. I agreed to design it for the purpose of seeing it built as I wished. That was the price I set for my work. I was not paid. My building was disfigured at the whim of others who took all the benefits of my work and gave me nothing in return. I came here to say that I do not recognize anyone's right to 1 minute of my life, nor to any part of my energy, nor to any achievement of mine, no matter who makes the claim. It had to be said. The world is perishing from an orgy of self-sacrificing. I came here to be heard in the name of every man of independence still left in the world. I wanted to state my terms. I do not care to work or live on any others. My terms are a man's right to exist for his own sake.
You're back with the Robert Jones Conservative Report. Call in numbers 347-884-8500. How many agree that it is a man's right, and by man I mean woman too, it is a man and a woman's, it is a human being's right to live for themselves, to produce, and to be paid for their productions in whatever currency they choose, be it monetary or simply to be acknowledged, but not to be forced, and not to be taken from, not to be looted. Where am I going? Where am I going with this? This idea of shared sacrifice, this idea that those of us who have an obligation to share with the have-nots, simply because we have and they have not. Our Christian values say that we are our brother's keeper, and I accept that, but should we be forced to be every man's keeper, to be everyone's keeper? Should we? Should we be forced to turn over our worldly goods, the money we earn from our sweat and hard labor, be it mental or physical labor, should we be forced to be taxed simply in order to pay for someone else's existence? Existence, not someone else's life, but someone else's existence. Our president said that in a speech not so long ago that he doesn't want to see corporate jet owners flying around in their jets, those fat cats, those millionaires and billionaires, earning their money when there's a mother who's sitting at her kitchen table trying to figure out how to send her kid to college. What do you think of that? Do you think it's my responsibility to help pay for everyone, anybody, to get into college? Isn't that what scholarships are for? Or maybe West Point, the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, or the Air Force Academy, or any school that gives out scholarships? Is it my responsibility? When the president says that at some point he believes that a person like me has earned too much money, has made too much money, there's a certain point where he believes that I've made too much money. What business is it of his? What business is it of that skinny little big-eared man in the White House how much money I make and how much I should be allowed to keep? He also used the term how much we should be allowed to keep. Are we living in the United States of America still, or are we in some banana republic where the President of the United States, our dear leader, gets to decide how much money we are allowed to keep so that he can take whatever he thinks is appropriate from us in order to give to someone else? Now, Huey Long had his proposals. Cap personal fortunes at $50 million each. This is in 1934. So that would be the equivalent of about $600 million today. He later reduced that figure to $5 to $8 million per millionaire, or 60 to 96 million in today's money. His proposal was to limit annual income to $1 million each. This was 1934 dollars, so that would be equal to about 12 million today. To limit inheritance to $5 million each. To guarantee every family an annual income of $2,000, or one-third the national average. Free college education and vocational training. Old age pensions for all persons over 60. Veterans benefits and health care. A 30-hour work week. A 4-week vacation for every worker. Greater regulation of commodity production and to stabilize prices. With all of that, folks, where's the money going to come from? Where is the money going to come from if Huey Long had his way? How much of what you just heard is also what's being proposed by our current president? Every man a king. That was Huey Long's motto, every man a king. But if every man's a king, then no man is a king.
How many men ever went to a barbecue and would let one man take off the table what's intended for 9/10 of the people to eat? The only way you'll ever be able feed the balance of the people. What's Morgan and Baruch and Rockefeller and Mellon going to do with all that grub? They can't eat it. They can't wear the clothes. They can't live in the house. But when they've got everything on the God's living earth that they can eat and they can wear and they can live in, and all that their children can live in and wear and eat and all their children's children can use, then we got to call Mr. Morgan and Mr. Mellon and Mr. Rockefeller back and say, come back here. Put that stuff back on this table here that you took away from here that you don't need. Leave something else for the American people to consume.
Exactly. Huey Long and Barack Obama are kindred spirits. Kindred spirits. They believe that those fat cats, those making over $250,000 a year, those fat cats, those millionaires and billionaires, you know, me, I'm not ashamed to say I make over $250,000 a year. So that would make me a millionaire and billionaire, or maybe I'm both. I don't know. It's hard to tell these days. So that means that those leftovers that I've got in my fridge, according to Barack Obama and Huey Long, those leftovers shouldn't be there. I should be giving those leftovers to some needy person. I shouldn't keep those leftovers in my fridge for later, because I already ate all I could eat at that particular sitting. So I should give the rest of that food away to somebody else. I've got some extra money in my pocket, money I'm not using right now. Maybe I should, according to Barack Obama and Mr. Long, I should go ahead and spread the wealth. That's really nice. And it's a really nice thought, isn't it, to share with others? Aren't we taught that in grade school, to share? But were we taught to share by force? Or were we taught that it's nice to do so, if that's what you'd like to do? Because that's not what's going on here. Because that's what charities are for. That's why our country has charitable contributions or deductions for money given to charities, things. But that's not what this president wants to do. He wants to force me to share my wealth, to force me to give my things away. Class warfare doesn't work. What Barack Obama is doing right here and now, Slim Jim, Southern Sense, Mays, David, New, Tesla, is he is setting up a situation where we're going to have riots and looting here in the United States, very much like what we saw, or what we've been seeing this last week in London, in England. This is what's so dangerous about this clown we have in the White House. When he talks about sharing the wealth and doing what's fair, he's basically saying to the young people of this country, it's owed to you. Those rich fat cats out there who fly corporate jets, those millionaires and billionaires, they owe you. How long before we see what happened in London happen here in the United States? How long before we see thugs and hoodlums and just plain old regular folks storming your local grocery store, your local Sam's Club and Walmart, storming it? Hundreds rushing in and just taking whatever they want. Just taking it. It's not going to be easy to stop them all. There are not enough police officers. We've seen this occur live in London and other parts of the world. So when the President of the United States continues to talk about those fat cats, well, Sam Walton's family, they're some of the fattest cats around, aren't they? Aren't they fat? Or Publix? Maybe they're owned by a bunch of fat cat jet owners. Let's all go out and loot and take those eggs and that bacon and that milk. My baby needs some milk. And those fat cats flying around in their corporate jets, well, they can afford to give me some of that milk or that bread or that cheese. They don't really need it. See, this is the danger of this guy. This is why he's got to go in 2012, in November, a first-class ticket. We'll ride. We'll send him home on Air Force Two. Why not? You know, he doesn't have to fly coach. But I swear to you right here and now that if this clown continues to point to those fat cats, those rich millionaires and billionaires, those corporate jet owners, and he continues to be irresponsible in overstating the need for the fat cats to pay their fair share. I'm so sick of hearing that from this clown, from this idiot. He is a moron. Because in my mind, this is what's touched off this rioting and looting in England. It wasn't about some guy being shot. It ceased to be about that after the first day. How did it go from some clown being shot, mistakenly or otherwise, to being about looting and robbing rich people and stores and looting? After the first day, no one talked about the person who got shot. They talked about robbing and stealing from rich people. So the next time you hear Barack Hussein Obama and the Democrats talk about fat cats, rich people, corporate jet owners, blah, 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 wah, 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 think about what could happen when you're out with your wife, your daughter, your husband, and you're just walking around and you're wearing a nice ring. You're wearing a nice watch. And a young man or a young woman walks up to you and says, "Hey, you're one of those fat cats that Barack Obama talked about. He says, the president says that you should pay your fair share. The president says that you need to pay your fair share. So give me that watch. And while you're at it, give me that wallet. I'm not robbing you, Mr. Jones. I'm not robbing you, Lee. I'm not robbing you, Mays. I'm not robbing you, Dave. I'm not robbing you, Tesla. I just want my fair share. I want what Barack Hussein Obama says that you owe me." So in absence, since the Republicans are so hell-bent on you not giving me my fair share, I'm going to take it from you. I'm going to take my fair share. Suppose You own a mom and pop. Suppose you work at a Walmart, or at a Publix, or a Piggly Wiggly, if you will, Southern. We know that the Piggly Wigglies are out in South Carolina. Suppose Southern finds herself shopping for groceries at the local Piggly Wiggly. A group of looters, 20 or 30 or so, decide they want to get some retribution. They want to get some restitution. They want some payback. They want the Piggly Wiggly chain, which is owned by a group of fat cats, no doubt, corporate jet owners. They want them to pay their fair share, and in absence of taking any money, they're going to go ahead and take a few things. Because Barack Obama said that you need to pay your fair share. I love Piggly Wiggly just as much as the next man. I love Publix. I even love Kroger. I use my Kroger Plus card all the time. Suppose I'm in Kroger tomorrow morning getting my two triple venti white mochas. I go there at the Publix Starbucks because they give me that extra shot for free. And thus, I'm paying $9.47 for two triple venti white mochas that I would get at the Starbucks down the road for almost a little more than $11. So I get mine from the Publix. So I'm in the Publix tomorrow morning like clockwork, and a bunch of hoodlums come in and say, "You got too many of those white chocolate mochas. Give me one. Because I deserve it." Obviously, if you can afford two, you can afford to give me one. You see where this is all going, folks? You see where it's all going? It's all going to hell. We have in our midst, as our president, another Huey Long. And Huey's saying, our new Huey Long is saying, spread the wealth. And if you don't spread the wealth, then damn it, I'm going to take it from you. That's what he's saying. I want to thank everybody for coming in the chat room tonight and listening. I want to thank all my guests for listening. You guys are great. I appreciate it. Thank you. There are so many things that you could be doing, but you come into my chat room, you listen to my show, and I do appreciate it. I really do, and I try to give you guys a good show. So thank you. Mays, New, Slim Jim, Southern, Tesler, CFGA, Lee, and my main man, David. Thank y'all for coming in, and I hope y'all have a really great night. Oh, boy. Watch your wallets. Obama's out to get you. He's out to get that jack. Good night, everybody.